Well, yeah, it's been suggested to me that maybe we have some questions about MSC, about missions, about some of the things I touched on. I touched on things, tried to get a sense across to you how rapidly the world is changing and our world here in Canada is changing. Many of those changes are going to impact us in lots of ways, and we need not fear that. We were talking at lunch about how some of the things actually help us, and some of them we should have been doing anyway. And the government's forcing us into things that aren't necessarily bad. You know, back in the day, if any of you were ever in camp work, you used to just go say, we need a new cabin here, and just go out and have a work party and pop the thing up in a weekend. Well, you can't do that anymore, right? And all the health regulations of running a camp are overwhelming. I'm still on the board at Wildwood Bible Camp. I've been involved there for 40, 50 years. And it's onerous. You might recall Elam Homes, which was up in the Midland area that closed recently. Again, it was just the overwhelming government regulations that eventually caught up with Elam. Just couldn't quite keep up. So we have to stay ahead of these things. We can't just say, oh, it doesn't apply to us, or just keep trusting the Lord and go on and do what we want. No, we have to say, and that's a big part of our job at MSC is helping to keep workers and donors and sending local churches compliant with the law and with the standards that are acceptable nowadays. Otherwise, we expose us all to, not just to lawsuits and things. It's not that we're fearful. It's that we have to understand that we're called upon to operate in the world as it is. We also have a lot of moving targets, because not only are the rules changing here, but the countries in which we operate. I was talking to someone, Rob, I guess, at lunch about India. A lot of people want to send money to particular workers in India. Well, the regulations in India are just absolutely onerous right now, and the Modi government has got any Christian organization squarely in the crosshairs. And they've kicked out many organizations. Compassion is out of India, you may have heard that. And other missions have just been kicked right out. Others have been severely curtailed. It's almost impossible now to send money into India, to the Lord's work in India. Very, very difficult. And I could explain more about that. So we've got a lot of things here that we have to be sure that we are compliant. And that doesn't hinder the gospel. The arm of the Lord is not shortened that he cannot save. We don't need to fear these things at all. But we have to do everything we can. And even when it comes to risk management, as we would call it, we have developed a very solid theology of risk management. Actually, I'm just going to take you through that. I'm kind of making this up on the fly in case. While you're thinking about any questions you might have, I'm going to quickly just take you through our theology of risk, if that's okay with you. Actually, I got a better idea. I just want to take you through a little bit to give you an example of some of the things we have to work through and think about. We talk about risk management, and we think about the theology of risk. And the reason we don't call it safety and security is we don't know if the Lord wants you to be safe and secure. They're not promised. The Lord never promised us. And a lot of people died in the Bible, right? A lot of servants of the Lord didn't go well. John the Baptist, he's in the dungeon. Jesus is out preaching. Ends up losing his head. I mean, you know, nobody's promised that. It's not always possible to keep people safe and secure. If you want to go and be a missionary in Yemen, we can't begin to guarantee your safety. Might not be God's will. And if they're seen as high values, it might actually hinder the work that God's called you to do. There's a high value here, safety, security. So risk management is a wise biblical choice. And, you know, we vacillate between the extremes. Freedom. I'm going to trust the Lord. I'm going to go out and just get on the plane, and I'm just going to go, and God will protect me. I don't think that's biblical. And yet fear, oh, it's a scary place, things that might happen, I don't know, I don't have any guarantees, I'm, you know. No, we would pull those things in. We would say that fear should move to faith, where we have faith that God has called us, and even if it goes badly, he will be with us. Right? Even if we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, he will be with us, and his rod and staff will comfort us. And then freedom turns to stewardship. Why? What's the difference? Well, stewardship is where you say, my freedom and my health and my life and my body are pretty important assets. In fact, it's the only irreplaceable thing. And I can buy a new car, I can do out of, you know, but my life is, I got one of those. And I don't mind laying it down for the life, but for the Lord, but I better take care of it. And we'll think much more about stewardship of money, and we'll be really concerned about that. But we don't think about the stewardship of our liberty, or our health, or our freedom, or our life. So we move that back in and say, you put faith and stewardship together, and you got what we would call risk management. So it's being the best possible stewards of the only irreplaceable asset that God has entrusted us with in order to fulfill the Great Commission, recognizing that we live and minister in communities. So that's, if you get killed or kidnapped or kicked out or jailed, it's going to impact the local church that you minister with, the believers that you know. It's going to impact your family. It's going to impact the people who are supporting you back home. It's going to impact MSC, that's for sure, and makes a big as a ripple. And so we don't just live in isolation. We don't minister in isolation. And we look at five times. You know all this list. I assume you're familiar with 2 Corinthians 11, where Paul recounts all of the things that he's endured. Incredible things. A lot of mission agencies wouldn't be excited about sending a worker into the kind of work where this kind of stuff could happen to him, because it exposes the organization. But of course, Paul did all that. And so the faith is essential to face and endure what the Lord might have for us. However, when the Lord sends out the people two by two, the disciples two by two, he says, don't take gold or silver, bag, extra shirt, sandals, in other words, provisions. And don't take a staff, which would be the protection if you're walking around from town to town. So we say, yeah, that's what we're talking about. Let's trust the Lord. Just go out and trust the Lord. That's what the Lord wants us to do. However, he said, next verse, I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. He didn't say there's not wolves, there's wolves, don't go. He says, be shrewd as serpents, innocent as doves, even though he's suggesting that the provision and the protection will be there. Supernatural, he's saying, you be wise and you be innocent. Act with appropriate wisdom. Then he says, be on your guard. What do you have to be on your guard for? He just told you he's going to miraculously provide and protect. But no, he says, be on your guard. He doesn't say, don't worry about safety. Don't think about it. And then he says, stand firm to the end. He's saying, expect opposition. Just because I'm giving you protection, you're going to have to stand. You're going to have to be prepared when things come. And when you're persecuted in one place, run away. That's in the passage about him supernaturally providing and protecting. And he says, don't be afraid. And that's the key. The key isn't whether we prepare or not, or whether we protect. The key is whether we're fearful. We can't be fearful people. We love our little lists of, you know, all the bad people who are going to go to hell. You know, the murderers and the idolaters and all those, that was list, and we forget that there's one in there that includes the fearful. Revelation, right? We'll see it in a minute. Risk management allows workers to be as safe and secure as reasonably possible so that they can fulfill the Great Commission work, even in hard and dangerous places. So it's not about them not going places. It's in actually freeing them up in order to be able to do it. Don't be afraid is a main message of the Bible. And so we could look through some of these places. There's one there, Revelation 21. But the fearful and the unbelieving, the abominable, murderers, and so on, will not have a place in eternal life. So then, this is an important change, because you'll recall at the end of Jesus' ministry, he turns to the disciples and he says, remember that time I sent you out two by two? And I told you to go without purse, bag, or sandals? No provisions, yeah? Did you lack anything? Nothing, he said. He said to them, but now, if you have a purse, take it, and also a bag. And if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. This is significant. Because even when he had promised supernatural protection and supernatural provision, he told them, be wise, be on your guard, stand firm, run away. And now he's saying, but now, provision and protection are going to be provided in the usual way, not the miraculous way. And sometimes we say the words, we're just trusting the Lord, but what we're actually doing is demanding a miracle of God every day. You know, it'd be an interesting thing. I came across the river when I came here, not too far away. It'd be interesting if at lunchtime, Andrew got up and said, okay, it's time for lunch now. We're all going to go down by the river and wait for the ravens. That's our plan. It's biblical, and it's faith and trust in God. So we got the faith. Yeah, let's go. Okay, let's go. Off to the river, wait for the ravens. That kind of demanding, we would never do that. We would say, oh, we got a lunch this Sunday. We better put up a schedule. Who's bringing a salad and a dessert? And thanks very much for the great food, folks. And sign up and bring your stuff. We don't want to end up with 28 salads and no desserts. 28 desserts and no salads, that's okay, but not the other way around. So we got to organize it. We got to get it there. We got to have the people here and people to clean up and people to do the... We plan. It's a predictable need that can be met in usual ways. And to demand a miracle for lunch would be inappropriate, unbiblical. And so when we know that there are predictable dangers and that there are means available to minimize those dangers, then we need to take them. To us, it's automatic. And that we always trust in God, but hey, we do our seatbelts up. You probably lock your house too. Why? Quick, cheap, and easy. Quick, cheap, and easy to take you from a risk of 8 to a risk of 2. So, Paul ran away a lot. I'm not going to read all these. There's at least 9 times he ran away. You know, we all know he set his face to Jerusalem and he went because he knew it would, you know, and people tried to talk him out of it, but the Holy Spirit told him to go and he went and he ended up eventually being killed for it because God told him to. But in the absence of that kind of direction, he ran away. And again, taking reasonable efforts based on the best available information. And so he stayed in Corinth because the Lord told him to. Keep on speaking. Don't be silent, for I'm with you. No one's going to attack and harm you because I have many people in this city. So Paul stayed. The Lord hadn't told him to, he would have run away again, I believe. And he was compelled by the Spirit, and he's going to Jerusalem. Holy Spirit warns him that prison and hardships are facing him. It's okay, because God has told him this is what it is. Where to go? In the absence of clear, direct leading of the Spirit, the default position for believers is to do everything they can to remain live witnesses. That's the default. We're here to be live witnesses. The Lord will take us home when it's his plan. In the meantime, keep yourself alive. Keep yourself healthy. Keep yourself fit and ready to serve. Good stewardship of the resources he's given to us. Risk is a very personal thing. We do not all have the same amount of faith. And we can tell people, say, your faith should be higher, but we all know. There is different varying. Faith is a gift. We're told that too, aren't we? And it's different. People have a certain amount of natural human courage. People have different views of stewardship. People have different ideas or different leading from God, what he's telling them to do. And some people have a natural risk tolerance. They can just handle things they don't know. I don't know how it's going to work out, but that's okay. We'll just go do it anyway. They can handle that. Other people can't. So We encourage our workers to work through those things and think, what's the mix that fits for you here? What's your level of risk tolerance in that? And how strong is your faith? How much are you convinced of God's calling in this situation? If you're not sure God's called you to stay in that war zone or to stay in that area where there's a lot of expat kidnapping going on, if you're not convinced of that, then maybe you better leave. So we would say, have you trusted God with your children? Sure. But we still put the medicine out of reach. We don't see it as a lack of trust to take it off the counter and put it up on a high shelf. Well, don't you trust the Lord? What are you doing that for? It would never occur to us to link those things. I trust the Lord, and I put the medicine out of reach. we put up, give up our seatbelts. But there's a whole lot of things that are quick, cheap, and easy that improve that. So that's something that we have developed over recent years, kinds of things that we... And so this idea of the tension between trusting the Lord and taking appropriate measures that are really essential in this day and age is one that we wrestle with a lot, and we think every Christian should wrestle with, because we often think it's one or the other. I'm either going to trust the Lord or I'm going to do it this way, and it's not that at all. We trust the Lord in everything, but we follow this. So that was a little bit of babbling my part while you thought of questions. So I hope you thought of questions. And it might be about charity law, or it might be about missions overseas, or it might be about the operations of MSC, or it could be about anything. And if you don't have any questions, we can all go home. This is a great format, by the way. We introduced this in a number of churches in Northern Ontario. There was quite a few assemblies up there that did this every week. This, have lunch, have another meeting, and go home. But man, it's tough to preach after lunch. Everybody's, yeah. Yeah, it's pretty bad. It's very bad. I was just there 2 weeks ago in Zimbabwe. The question was, could I address the situation in Zimbabwe? Yeah, Zimbabwe's are in real total shambles. The main water has been shut off for, I think, about 2 weeks now, 10 days to 2 weeks. That is, nobody anywhere is getting any water. So, you know, that means that in the city, all your, you know, toilets in the public schools, all this stuff, nothing's working. No water anywhere. There are some people of means who have drilled boreholes and have wells, drilled wells, but the problem is all the water's getting sucked out of the water table in the city of Harare, and that's falling fast. So they're very much on the brink of no water from any means, anywhere. When we were there, electricity was typically on from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. That was all the electricity you had in the cities, in the country. So you could leave your cell phone and computer charging overnight, but in terms of having electricity outside those hours, there wasn't any. Obviously, there's a lot of suffering that results from that. Those are just two sort of easy markers that help identify how bad things are. But it's pretty grim, very grim. It's also very grim in Haiti right now. Like, it's been bad in Haiti forever. And it's always sort of been degrees of evil. But it seems particularly bad this last week, even the last couple of days. It's just utter chaos down there. Depends on where you are in the country, but much of the country has been without electricity for a long time. Limited water running through the taps in many areas. And a tremendous amount of danger out on the roads. That's the difference. There's not too much sort of civil unrest obvious in the streets in Zimbabwe, but it certainly will blow eventually. But there is right now in Haiti. We have three workers currently there. Tony Jones, he's going to be up in the area. I don't know if he'll be around here or not, but he might be known to some of you. He's on the board. I want to commend you, by the way, whoever does this, but in spite of our best efforts to train our workers, some of our workers have multi-page newsletters, and somebody clearly takes the time to staple them, put them up. You can open the letter. Not many places do that. And I tell the workers that. I say, listen, better to send a one-page thing with smaller pictures and send it every 2 weeks or something than to send a great big long one every three or four or every 2 months or something, because people don't get put up on the board and nobody can read the other side. So, but somebody here has solved that problem, and I commend you for that. And if you're not in the habit of taking a look at that board around that corner, please do. So Tony's been down for a while. He's a great missionary, and he's living in very tough conditions. Lori Louie works in a town called Mirablay at an orphanage, and she's a little better off because they have some generators there and they can get a bit of water. And then a young woman, Jamie Weber, is a nurse down there as well. So pray for Haiti and pray for Zim. That'd be good. Those are probably two of the hotter spots this week. Thanks for asking. Any other questions? Yes. Yes, Mr. Steele. Becoming increasingly common and will become more common as we move forward. I have no doubt about that. We had this idea that was really born out of logistics in the late 1800s and 1900s of people going to one place, fully funded expat workers going to one foreign location for life. And you were gone. And that was what a real missionary looked like. Of course, it's not. We don't have any evidence of that in the Bible. Paul went all kinds of places for very short terms. And it seems like he never stayed anywhere longer than 2 years in Ephesus. So it's nothing biblical about that model. We just did it. And again, why? Because it took you 3 months to get there on a boat, and a very high percentage of the people died on their first term on the field. So you had to stay a long term. Plus, nobody knew the languages. The Bible wasn't translated into those languages. And to this day, of course, when you have new tribes, or as now ethnos or Wycliffe workers, they have a 20 to 30 year commitment. They got to learn the language from scratch. They got to create a written language. Then they got to translate the New Testament into the, you know, it's going to take that long. So they have that kind of lengthy commitment. But in many, many, many of the countries where there are believers, there are Bibles in the native language, for people to go to a couple years, our roles have changed. And typically they're going to encourage the church. Or what the big need is, you get people who get saved and local churches get established, but there isn't that sort of core of knowledgeable believers who really know the word thoroughly and sort of at that next level, if it were, who can help make decisions and guide the local church and can frame things properly theologically and doctrinally and know the word. And often our roles nowadays are to go in and work with a handful of promising young believers who are sincere in their faith, and help them become national leaders who can then duplicate that model out. I think that's a major role for Western missionaries now. So, sorry, I'm not very good at short answers, but the answer there is that, yeah, that's going to be a very common way for people to go for a couple of years and with a particular goal. And again, that's what we like to help people with, the philosophy and strategy. What are you going to do? Okay, you're going to be a missionary. Well, you know, in most countries, the idea of a Westerner going into that culture and doing primary evangelizing in the marketplace or door to door or something like that, it really shouldn't be happening. We should be going over and enabling and equipping the believers who are there to go reach their own people and mobilizing them and teaching and helping them to go. They should be doing the primary evangelism. I'd like to say, if a Korean church right now is sending out many missionaries all around the world, a very growing missionary community, and I like to say, you know, a lot of our missionaries just kind of show up on the field. And what would happen if some Korean missionaries moved up the street here and just showed up next Sunday? And they walk in here, and they're here to strengthen the church. They're here to help you grow. Oh, okay. Thanks for coming. And now they start telling you, hey, you're not doing this right. You're not doing that right. And you know what? This place could use a little freshening up. I tell you, we'll get $200,000. Next week, and we'll come in and we'll, you know, and we'll pay to have this done and pay to have that done stuff. And not only that, but we're going to go around this neighborhood all week and do door-to-door evangelism. How does that make you feel sitting here at Emerson Heights as someone who's been going here for all these years? You say, wow, they got money, they can make stuff happen, they're going to go out and do our evangelism for us? Cool. I guess I don't have to come clean the chapel next week because Koreans will do it. And I don't have to worry about my neighbor because sooner or later they'll hit them. You see the dynamic there. And there's lots of places where there's been believers there for 100 years, and we have new missionaries going in to help the church. And they come in and they see these deficits. Oh, there's no evangelism going on, or they can't afford to put new tiles down, or they can't afford to keep this, so I'll get some money, we'll do it. And to us, it's only, you know, $5,000. To them, it's like a massive amount of money. We just make, not only that, but we can make everything happen so fast. And the National Church never grows, never grows, never takes ownership. Remember I said those words, ownership, sustain, ownership, sustainability, succession, transference? So ownership is, whose work is it? Are they helping us do our thing? Or are we helping them do their thing? And many missionary generations have never gone in and sat down and spent 2 years just getting to know the people and listening to them. And then saying, after 2 years, saying, so what do you think your biggest need is here? What do you think it is? And what they say their biggest need is probably won't be our idea of what the biggest need is. So now we have a problem. Are we going to say, no, 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 that's not your biggest need. Let me tell you what your biggest need is. Or are we going to say, okay, now how would you like us to help you meet that need? Because the way they tell us they want us to help them isn't going to be what we would do either. So typically we haven't done that. We've come in, we've looked for 5 minutes and say, here's your problem. Let me tell you what it is. Not only that, here's your solution, and here's how I'm going to make that happen. Boom. And that's been the dynamic on the mission field for 100 years. Now, it's fine in the pioneer stage, but we're well past that in most of the countries, most all of the typical receiving countries. We're well past that. So how do we move, how do we listen to them? What do they think our role should be? How can we help you do your thing? That's ownership. It's their work. I mean, it's the Lord's work, but you understand what I mean. Psychologically, morally, emotionally. Is it their work? Yeah, it's their work. This is your work here at Edmiston. And missionaries from Korea coming in and telling you what to do isn't going to be well received. And isn't going to be helpful. So, I just realized my plug was out here. There we go. So, that's the kind of thing we like to think through, how that's going to happen. So, Don, that was a very, very long answer to your question. Except that it's important to be thinking these things through. And we have a lot of people sitting in a lot of pews all across Canada who think somebody who went out for 2 years and comes back isn't a real missionary. But you try doing it. I also often counsel missionaries who are very upset. Say, I went out for 4 years and I came home and now people are saying to me, how come you're back? What are you doing back? And I say, listen, if somebody says to you, how come you're back? Say, how come you never went? They usually laugh. And I say, well, think about it. Somehow you quit your job, sold your house, moved your family to Timbuktu for 4 years, and now you're a bad guy because you're back. We don't think this fully funded for life thing is, we think that model is closing very quickly. More people are taking jobs. If a young couple comes to me or a young person comes to me and says, I believe the Lord's calling me to some hard mission field. I don't know where. I don't know when. How do I get ready? Should I go to Bible school? What should I do? I tell them, when you get an idea what region you're going to, you find out what they really need. Do they need physiotherapists? Who do they need? Dental hygienists? Do they need people who can work with special needs? That's a huge field right now. That's wide open. The whole Arab Muslim world doesn't know what to do with special needs individuals. Many of the families have locked the kid up in a shed in the backyard for years, or literally chained him in the back behind the house. They're not seen in public. There's no facilities. There's no programs. There's no education. Nothing. And we've got a couple of people working with special needs in difficult places. It's fantastic. They take them out for 6 weeks into a residential plant program. They teach them how to basic hygiene, how to dress themselves, how to do basic human life skills. And then they bring the family and train the family how to help the person do that. And then they send them home for 6 weeks. And then they bring them back into 6 weeks and try to take them to the next level. And repeat that cycle, 6 weeks at home, 6 weeks in the residential. And eventually the people become much higher functioning and much more a part of the family. They take them out into the neighborhood, into the parks and things, which is not done, and because you don't see those kinds of people, and now they do, and they do that all in the name of Christ, overtly. They're singing Sunday school songs with them, and Christian doing devotions in that, as much for the benefit of the staff, the Muslim staff that would be, you know, cleaners and assistants and nurses and things, as for the individuals themselves. And then the parents come, and it's just not uncommon to see all these parents sitting around the room singing these songs. And so it's a great thing. These are all options that are not our normal model of missions. Business's mission needs to grow, taking special professions into a country, just immigrating into that country and taking a legitimate job, but taking Christ in, and not necessarily starting with Bible studies and church planting, but just starting with being the presence of Christ in that neighborhood over the long term. It's a huge need in many of these countries where there just aren't Christians, very few of them. And that's how it starts. And so the idea of taking a legitimate job, it does a lot of things. It gives you instant credibility. When a fully funded expat missionary walks into a new community, people are saying, who's that family up the road? I don't know. I don't know either. They seem to have a lot of money. I don't know what they do. They don't go to work. They got more than I do, and they don't seem to do anything. I don't know who they are, and it's kind of weird. But you go in as a physiotherapist or a special needs practitioner or some other person that's going to bring value, your instant credibility. Oh, this person up the street, they've come in to work at the hospital as a physio. That's great. Our physio department's been shut down. I've been in many hospitals, by the way, where physiotherapy on the door hasn't had anybody in there for years. And qualified physiotherapist comes in and says, how about if I open this up for you and get a program going? They'll welcome you with open arms. Instant credibility, instant contacts. Your first day there, you're going to meet 50 people, all who think you're wonderful, as opposed to if you're a missionary knocking on doors. Completely different. And then thirdly, you're making a significant contribution to the community beyond sharing the gospel, but you're actually coming to give. You're dispensing the grace of God. Here's what it feels like to have God come near you. And it's a contribution. So these kinds of things are the way forward in missions. The things that we like to stimulate thinking in the minds of those who are the next generation going out. Be careful about asking another question because you're going to get a long answer. Yes? Okay, well, so what happens is the infrastructure, which was all built in colonial times, Zimbabwe was one of the last countries to get their independence in 1980, and all of that infrastructure has just been deteriorating and deteriorating, and any money that comes in to fix it goes into the pockets of the fat cats, and so it never has gotten, and it's just been down and down and down, and so they finally had to start sharing. They didn't have the capacity. If they had 20 pumps, they had 10, and then they had 5, and then they had 2, and they were rotating water cuts for years where this neighborhood gets it today and they get it tomorrow and whatever, for hours sometimes, not even a whole day. And now it's just completely collapsed. They don't have the chemicals to treat the water. They don't have the electricity to run all the pumps and stuff, and the actual equipment's just in such disrepair that it won't work. Same thing in the electrical. Kariba Dam was a massive hydroelectric program, and the Wangi coal, you said it wasn't going to be a long answer. You don't know me very well. Anyway, so it's all infrastructure related. I could tell you all the details, but it's just the matter of the money that was available to repair and replace and maintain this infrastructure has been absconded with over the years and never put into it, and now it's all into collapse. And the donor fatigue among the donor nations who would keep this infrastructure going, they're saying, we already gave you $8 gazillion to fix this. We're not giving you now anymore to fix it now. So that's what creates that crisis. Yes, sir. Yeah. So it all depends on, you're talking about the decision to come or you're talking about the finances? Both. So typically that we would want the assembly and the worker to arrive at that together, just as they would go out that way. We would if we became aware of something on the field that we thought required the worker to come home, our first call would be to the elders of the commending assembly. And we would say, here's a concern we have. Are you aware of it? If yes or if no, let's get together and talk. But the assembly drives the bus. We just help. So we would say, you know what, we think there's a lot going on here. We think this is a real cross-cultural thing in that country. We think there's other things happening or whatever. We might know something that the average elder wouldn't necessarily be up to speed on. So we work together. If it's a real problem, we would say, suggest, why don't you designate an elder and one of us will go with one of you, and the two of us will go out there and see if we can sort this out. If it's a health condition or a condition where they need treatment, obviously that's different. Let's get them home and looked after. We seek to be as helpful as we can with finances in a situation like that. If it's a moral failure, we probably want them off the field as quick as possible and deal with it this side, whatever happened, even if it's just come home for a while. If it's a health thing, if it's a crime and safety thing, or a natural disaster kind of thing, again, that kind of evacuation, we would probably take the lead and make some recommendations, but it's going to be up to the... We never tell someone they have to come home. We work with the assembly. Financially, we do what we can. So at MSC, typically we under-promise and over-deliver. We rely on the Lord for the funds that we get in. We never know what we're getting. And if we deducted 10%, we would know what's coming in and we'd know what we have, but we don't do that. So we don't have a lot of promises. But we do have evacuation funds, and we do set them aside, and we have always been able to help when needed so far. Now, did I answer your question? Okay. Yes? So the admins, that's from admin donations, people who intentionally give to our administration costs, and we don't solicit that. We try to give information. Without solicitation, but we leave it entirely up to the donors to designate funds separate from their missions giving to our admin costs. Yeah, so we meet with every new worker going outside the country. We physically meet with the elders, whether it's down in Brantford or whether it's in Coquitlam, BC. We get on a plane and go out and sit down, and we give them stuff. But in terms of online resources and that, we have some stuff online, but we tend to sort of zero in when people are actually going overseas and give those particular elders the information that we have or that we feel they need to have to work with us in supporting this worker. And there's no books or anything because we're sort of a unique model, so it just has to be done. So that's another thing. That's expensive to get on a plane and go for every new worker and sit down. But every time, there's only been once or twice in the last 8 years that we haven't done that for various reasons, didn't permit it, and we've always regretted it. Always regretted it. Because when something isn't going well, to not have had that relationship with the sending local church is a problem, and it's really great when you have had the time to explain the model carefully. Our biggest problem are folks who have heard of MSC all their life, but aren't really up to date on what's happening with MSC and the world and missions and all that. And so maybe they commended a worker 20, 30 years ago and said, oh yeah, we know all about MSC. We use it all the time, send a check every month. Everything's great. We get the magazine, we get your thing. It's all great. Big fans. Yeah, but thanks. But you don't really understand how it works. Oh yeah, we do. No. I think we need to come. Oh no, you don't need to come all the way out here to Calgary. They said, no. We're going to come. We're going to be there. And we're always glad we did. And they're always glad we did. And we find it's very worth. Yeah, so they have to be there has to be some charity that will serve them. So if it's not us, who is it? And it can be their commending assembly, but most, like for instance, if Edmondson sends out some guy out as a just a general worker, out in the work, as we used to say, sending Bob out in the work. Everybody knew what that meant. Everybody reached for their wallet. You know, that's what it meant. And look after this guy, and let's take care of him. And the funds would come. More itinerant Canadian workers now are operating. They didn't intend to, but what is happening is, it's happening much more as like a fee for service. So when people come to preach, the amount that they're typically getting, at least this is what they're telling me, the amount they're typically getting is more, even with inflation, than it used to be. But just sort of being generally supported, $100 a month here and there, for not tied to a particular service, that's diminishing. Fewer people who are just supporting them out in the work. That's going to bring about changes. I don't know what they'll be, but there'll be changes. And so if, from CRA's perspective, if Edmondson Heights sends out somebody in the work, then it's fine for Edmondson Heights to give them money. That's easy. But if another assembly gives them money directly, they have to be able to make the case that this guy is their agent doing their work. And that's a tough case to make. It happens all the time. But in actual fact, it's not wise for Edmondson to give a worker from another assembly that isn't speaking here just general funds. You're better to send it to us, because we have an agency agreement with that worker that says they are our agent doing our work, and we can give them money directly. You could send it to their commending assembly, but their bookkeeper probably doesn't want a whole lot of $50 checks every month and have to. That's one of the reasons we exist too, is even if Emerson wants, the people in Emerson wanted to support that worker, for you to all give your $50 to the bookkeeper here who has to do all that, you just send it to us and we take care of that for you. Did I answer your question? No. So we always take our directions from the sending church. So Saint Church has to send us a letter saying, "Would you please serve this person?" Which amounts to a letter of commendation, and then we enter into an agency agreement with that person, whereby on the legal frequency, they're our agent doing our work, and then we can accept donations from anywhere from them, and then they have to report to us on their activities every quarter. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Our administrative costs are not covered by administrative donations, but they are covered because aging people leave us funds in their will. And so we get some estate money into our general fund, so we can transfer some funds out of our general fund to cover our admin. But we're looking ahead and we're saying all those kinds of people who were wired to donate that way are in fact dying. And as a sustainable model, we have to be more informative that, you know, this is like a co-op. Yes, it's low cost, but it's not no cost. It's the by far the cheapest missions thing going anywhere. And we're big. I don't know if I mentioned to someone at the table. Out of all charities in Canada, there's 87,500 charities in Canada. We're in the top 0.1% of charities. And of faith-based charities, we're in the top 0.01%. And there's only 5,000 charities in Canada out of the 87,500 that send funds outside the country, which is really what the CRA cares about a lot. And out of those 5,000, we're number 121. Like, we're bigger than a lot of other mission organizations you've heard of. My little line that I use a lot is, MSC is the largest missions organization you've never heard of. Because most people, they know all about New Tribes and SIM and Wycliffe, and they know about all those names. We're bigger than several of those, in terms of the number of dollars of donations, the number of workers in the field, number of new workers going out. There are mission organizations out there that have two or three couples doing nothing but recruitment. They go around to the Bible colleges and youth camps and that, trying to recruit people into their missionary training program to send them overseas. And they're excited if they get two couples a year going overseas, or three. Well, you know, I think the lowest year in the 8 years I've been there has been 13. It's been the lowest number of new workers going overseas. And 1 year it was 20, I can't remember if it was 23 or 27, 2 years ago, but that was the highest. So I don't say that to blow our horn, just to say that sometimes in the Brethren movement we have a pretty big inferiority complex. And, you know, and it's one of the things I was over in Rome at the International Brethren Conference and Mission, you know, 1,000 people from 122 countries, all in the Brethren movement. That's a wide spectrum, granted, from quite conservative, more conservative than places that we would be familiar with, to very progressive. It's a wide spectrum, but nonetheless, they would all say they're part of the Brethren movement, and we see great things going on around the world, and it's important to remember that. And same within missions. We per capita, we're right up there as one of the leading missions groups, denominations, non-denominations. Don't want to get myself in trouble. In the evangelical world. So we should feel good about that. CMML in the States? No, that's just Canada. That's just us. Just us, yeah? That's just us. Yeah, CMML is, they have perhaps, I forget what their total is in terms of total numbers on the field. But everything in the States should be 10 times bigger than Canada, right? Because our population and GDP and everything else is about 10%. But we're much closer than that. You know what? I think we should wind up. One more question. Yes, brother, I see that hand. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you mean you?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Because no, the reason I say that is that we answer the question carefully because we would be delighted to have someone like you coming. You're in the Lord's work. You don't know what he has for you down the road. You'd love to be more prepared. You'd love to understand more about missions. It'd be great. We try to avoid getting the 19, 20-year-old who sort of doesn't know what he's going to do in June because camp doesn't start till July, so maybe I'll go to MOP. Yeah, so it's typically populated by very serious people who are on their way to the field. Maybe half the people who are there, they know when they're going and where they're going. The other half think they're going somewhere, and there's usually a few who think, someday maybe I'd love to know more. But they're serious. It's not a youth camp. It's a pretty intense program, and so that's really all we care about, Andrew, is that the people who are there are going to be focused and into it and not filling in time. I'm going to suggest we close in prayer. I want to thank you for your questions and your interest and for staying around after lunch. And then if anybody has further questions, I'm not in a rush, so you're welcome to come up and ask for them. Let's just pray. Father, just talking this morning reminds us that we are part of your church around the globe, and that you will build your church, and that you will accomplish your purposes, that you don't need our cleverness or our strategies, you don't need even our willingness to go, but you are pleased to use that. You allow us to be involved in your work. Sometimes we're astounded at that. We don't even understand it. But we are grateful that we all have roles to play. And so I just ask your blessing on the believers here at Edmiston Heights, that you would show them their role, whether it be in this neighborhood or in their personal neighborhoods or workplaces or wherever, whether it be to pray, whether it be to give. Thank you for the missionary interest that exists here and has for decades. We want to pray for the upcoming missionary breakfast in a month, for all those who will come to that, for the workers who will participate. We commit that to you as well. So, Father, we just are so grateful that we know you and you know us, that you care for us, you provide for us, and give us what we need, and that we have the privilege of serving you. And we give thanks for all these things in the name of the Lord Jesus. Amen. Mm-hmm.